Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 6, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the new Trail of Tears, Property and Poverty on Native American Reservations. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Naomi Schaefer Riley, New York Post columnist and author of a new book on our topic, and Timothy Sandifer, Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute. Timothy will interview Naomi about her new book, and then we will open the floor for your questions. Thank you both for speaking with us, and Timothy, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, and I'm really honored to have the opportunity to interview Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's a New York Post columnist, formerly with the Wall Street Journal, and an author of this fantastic new book, The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying Americans, a mercifully brief examination of some of the problems confronting the reservations primarily in this country. And thank you for joining me, Naomi.
Oh, thanks very much.
Am I right? This is your fifth book?
Yes.
That's right. What got you interested in writing about American Indians?
Well, it was primarily, I guess, curiosity. Years of just reading stories about the deplorable conditions on reservations. I'm sure a lot of listeners have just read the stories about suicide epidemics and alcoholism and poor education systems. And while I was at the Wall Street Journal, I actually would periodically ask writers, I was an editor, if they would be interested in taking up one of these topics. And I typically got two responses. One was, I know nothing about this. And the second was, I would not touch this topic with a 10-foot pole. So you can imagine that sort of stirred some interest in the reporter in me.
Yeah. Well, and let's start with some of those statistics, because I think they're shocking beyond words. Suicide rates, just some of the things that are mentioned in your book, suicide rates among Native Americans are more than twice the national average, and suicide is the leading cause of death among American Indian boys ages 10 to 14. In Canada, in April, 11 people on the Ottawa-Piscat Reserve attempted suicide on only a single day. 9 of them were children. The poverty rate on reservations is 28.4%, which is about twice the national average. On the Pine Ridge Reservation, 53% of people live in poverty. On the San Carlos Reservation here in my home state of Arizona, 25% of the people live in what the government calls extreme poverty. Per capita income on the Navajo Reservation, which is 2.5 times the size of Massachusetts and is the home of about 175,000 people, the per capita income there is about $7,000 a year, and on the San Carlos Reservation, it's half that. More than a third of the homes on the Navajo Reservation have no electricity and no plumbing, and half of all reservation homes have no telephone service at all, which is 10 times the national average of households without telephone service. That's really shocking.
Yeah, I think most people, when I read off the list of statistics, those included, and also rates of sexual assault and child abuse, I think they're sort of left shaking their heads. And I think for a lot of people, you know, they sort of go back to what they learned in school, which is typically we did terrible things to American Indians 200 years ago, 150 years ago, 100 years ago, and we have left them in this deplorable state, and there's really little we can do now to get them out.
Yeah, I was just watching over the weekend, actually, a relatively new film that came out called Songs My Brother Taught Me. Are you familiar with this movie?
No, I'm not.
It's filmed on location on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and it's largely cast of people. There's very few actors in it. It's mostly made up of people who live on the reservation who are basically playing themselves. It's a fictional story, but it's very much a slice of life into the reservation. It's one of the most horrific things I've ever seen. And it's just really, really eye-opening. One central point in your book is that the poverty that we're talking about is largely caused by the lack of private property rights on reservations. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, I think a lot of people, and maybe your listeners are not included among this group, but I think a lot of people are not truly aware of what a reservation actually is. A reservation, obviously, they started off as simply a way for us to push Native Americans out of the way as we pursued manifest destiny, as American pioneers and settlers did. But now reservations are a way that the federal government holds land in trust for the American Indians. The only other people we legally hold things in trust for are children and the mentally incompetent. So I think it's pretty shocking that this is still the terminology and the policy that we use to deal with Native American land questions. But the land is held in trust, and that has enormous effects on the economy of these reservations. The first problem is that American Indians technically don't own their land. They can't buy it and sell it even amongst themselves without the permission of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Many Indians jokingly refer to the BIA as bossing Indians around. But it's true. I mean, one man I talked to who was on the he's part Crow, part Northern Cheyenne, was telling me that he had arranged with his neighbor to buy a few acres of land so he could graze some cattle. And he and his neighbor had agreed on a price that the neighbor was going to sell him the land at. And then a Bureau of Indian Affairs official said, no, you can't do that because that's not fair market value for the land. So that's sort of the beginning of it. Obviously, anybody who understands economics understands that fair market value is actually what someone will pay for the land. But the BIA had recently had someone come appraise the land and had, according to this man, specifically told the appraiser, we want to make the price high so as not to screw over the Indians. Of course, that's exactly what ended up happening because the man I spoke to did not get the land to graze the cattle, and the guy who was trying to sell it did not get the money. But it goes much, much further than the buying and the selling, obviously. The biggest problem, of course, is that American Indians can't go to a bank and get a mortgage because any banker would tell you if you don't have the underlying title to the land, you know, what am I going to have as collateral? And the answer is nothing. So, no, you can't have a mortgage. And I read a statistic recently that said about, I think, at least a quarter of small business owners actually use the equity of their home to get a second mortgage in order to buy a small business. To start a small business to get the capital that they need, and American Indians don't have access to that either. And that doesn't even get also into questions of all of the natural resource development that cannot occur on Indian lands without huge amounts of bureaucracy getting in the way. So those are, I think, some of the problems with the trust policy that we talk about when we're talking about reservations.
There was a review of your book the other day in Indian Country Today, and unsurprisingly, it takes an opposite view from you. And the writer comments on what you just said in a way that I thought was rather revealing. He says, Riley commends the Dawes Allotment Act. Her only criticism, it didn't go far enough in imposing a private property regime on the Indians. What would you say in response to that?
Right. Well, that's exactly correct, except for the imposing a private property regime part. I do like that language. The Dawes Act, many people sort of understand the Dawes Act as having given Indians an opportunity to have private property. In fact, what the Dawes Act offered them was something much less than that. First of all, it said that Indians may be assigned a piece of land, and that assignment was sort of done by the federal government often in unfair ways. Non-Indians were given access to the best land available. But even beyond that, once an Indian was technically given a piece of property, they were actually had to hold it for 25 years before they could technically own it outright. That is to say, the federal government had to deem the Indian mature enough in some way for him to be able to buy it or sell it, or, you know, be able to buy or sell pieces from other people and combine it to get economies of scale or anything like that. And so I tell people it's like, you know, if your aunt, you know, left you money in trust, and said, you know, you can have access to this in 25 years, but wait, in 25 years, there'll be some other random person who gets to decide whether you're mature enough to actually have that money. You're not really much wealthier today than you were yesterday because you don't actually have the capital.
Yeah, it brings to mind there was a paper just published, I think last month, by the Cato Institute, that looked back at the policies taken by former communist countries in the Soviet bloc when they went to a more market-based economy. And they, the, you know, there, at, in the late 80s and the early 90s, there was this question whether you should go slow in privatization or whether you should just open it up really quickly to privatization. And the authors conclude that the going slow route was the wrong decision, that it ended up that things didn't get really privatized at all. It turned into more bureaucracy.
Right, that's definitely the case. I mean, Terry Anderson at PERC has written extensively about this question of, you know, how the bureaucracy is kind of expanded in order to it's created more jobs for itself. And there are actually 9,000 employees currently at the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Bureau of Indian Education combined, which is approximately one official for every 110 people living on a reservation. I liken it to them each being kind of principals at a small school of 100 kids who they see it as their job to oversee. And I think in terms of the question of whether to privatize rapidly or slowly, obviously the result has been an enormous amount not only of bureaucracy but also just of corruption, that the more people you sort of put in charge of your life, the more people you put in charge of other people's property, the worse it's going to be for the individual.
Yeah, what you say about the 1-to-100 ratio reminds me of an old joke that Walter Williams is fond of telling about the time he was walking through the Department of Agriculture and he saw a bureaucrat crying at his desk and he said to him, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" And the bureaucrat said, "My farmer died."
That's exactly it. Yes. Unfortunately, nothing. Even if the American Indian population declined dramatically, it's hard to imagine that the Bureau of Indian Affairs ever would.
But, you know, this line about imposing a private property regime on Indians, I think it reminded me of, I've always thought that one of the crippling problems that Indians face in the country is the mythology of the propertyless Indian. And I think your opening chapters do an excellent job of showing how the idea that Indians didn't have private property rights is an absurd mythology. Talk a little bit about that.
So this was, I think, one of my most interesting visits. I actually went up to Canada, to British Columbia, which has a very significant, what they call First Nations population. They tend to be a little bit better off than some American Indians. They actually have a significant amount more political power than American Indians because, in part, they're concentrated very much in British Columbia, and so they actually, can make or break whether, they send that particular region send someone to Parliament, for instance. But I think one of the most interesting conversations I had there was with a man named Manny Jules, who has really spearheaded a movement to get natives to recognize their own heritage in this regard. And, you know, he talks about, not only his own growing up, but his father's growing up, and his father was also very significant in this movement. He said, when my people, migrated from one place to another, we didn't come back expecting that somebody else was going to be living in our hut when we came back. It wasn't this free-for-all where everybody owned everything. And I think, he rightly points to the ways in which American academia in particular, and Canadian academia as well, have sort of tried to suggest that these reserves and reservations are really kind of environmentalist, socialist utopias that we need to preserve, and that doing so would actually be some kind of cultural benefit to American Indians, when in fact, there's been plenty of research showing that American Indians owned things individually or as nuclear families, not necessarily as a whole tribe. But we have this kind of image that it's patronizing, and it's caused enormous problems for them, that we think they all want to be socialists. And my interviews suggest that's absolutely not the case.
Yeah, if they had all wanted to be socialists, they hardly would have survived on their own in North America for thousands of years. Actually, it brought to mind, there's a passage in Ian Fraser's 2000 book, On the Res, that I have always thought just symbolized perfectly this problem. There's a scene when – have you read his book?
Yes.
Yeah, you remember it's about Pine Ridge, and there's this passage where he's coming home from a rodeo with some Sioux friends in the car. He's white himself, and as they're coming down into the valley, he says, "I have the quote." He says, "As we approached Pine Ridge, we came over a rise and saw the lights of the village spread out across the dark prairie. I remarked that they looked like the lights of Los Angeles seen from Mulholland Drive and said how pretty it was. Wanda said, more clearly than I've ever heard her say anything, it looks pretty, but it's just a slum." And it struck me that a lot of the problem that Indians face in this country is white romanticism of the Indian situation. What do you think of that?
The lights reminded me, and I want to get to your question, but when I was in Canada, I was actually visiting a city called Kamloops, and it's one of the most, I think, stark representations of the difference in economic activity between places that are reservations and places that are not. One of the people who was taking me around there took me up to the top of this hill, and you could see on one side of the Kamloops River was actually, where it was reservation land, and one side it was not. And I would say, without too much exaggeration, it was like the difference between North and South Korea. The what was on the reservation side was just, it was all temporary, a few warehouses, the buildings were falling down, even the cemeteries were falling apart. Meanwhile, on the other side of the river, it was this bustling tourist town, which had enormous amounts of natural resource development. Two Canadian railroads met there. It was this place where people couldn't wait to come and visit and move to. And it was just, to me, so interesting that you have these two different situations. They have the exact same kind of natural resources available to them, the same kind of beauty of the land, and what has happened on one versus what has happened on the other. It's something where I think, economics 101 should be taking field trips to some of these places to just understand what people like Hernando de Soto are talking about. To answer your question about American romanticism, I think that is a great deal of it. I think it starts in just American ignorance. I mean, when I started, I said that, most Americans, to the extent that they think about American Indians at all, they think back to things that they learned about this history 100 years ago or more. There's a college professor I quote in my book who, has a bunch of freshmen come into a class where she's about to teach something about Native Americans, and more than half the class thinks that they're all dead. I mean, I don't even think that there is a sense of, for the people who think about it, maybe there's romanticism, but for most people, it's either just complete ignorance or just the total absence of a desire to think about any of this. So
yeah.
I think that the problems are maybe at the height of the problem, it's romanticism, but underneath, I think it's just a lot of ignorance.
Yeah, it's out of sight, out of mind. What you say about looking over the river reminds me of the passage in Democracy in America where Tocqueville describes the difference on either side of the Ohio River between the slave state of Kentucky and the free state of Ohio, and how on one side everything is bustling activity and on the other side it's all drowsy and slow, because on the northern side of the river there's a society that prizes entrepreneurship and hard work, and on the other side there's a society that denigrates entrepreneurship and hard work. Do you think a similar effect is going on here?
I absolutely think so. I went to the center of many of these communities, and you just find people hanging around. I don't think that this is the stereotype of the lazy Indian, but that's not really what's going on here. What's really going on here is there is nothing for them to do. Essentially, they're waiting around for someone to die to get a job, because most of the jobs are either from the Bureau of Indian Affairs or paid for by the tribe. I mean, there is no private sector on these reservations. In a sense, you could hardly fault these people for lacking any sense of entrepreneurship. It's not just that entrepreneurship is not prized. It's not rewarded in any sense. There is no – even if you are a child on one of these reservations, and let's just say you try to work hard all the way through school – And you graduate and your opportunities on the reservation are almost non-existent. And the likelihood is that before you get to that point, you will be shown a culture that just where merit is not rewarded. Forget about entrepreneurship. I mean, I spoke to several teachers on these reservations, and that was probably one of the most disheartening parts of my research. But one teacher in particular was telling me that, you know, the teaching jobs are actually one of the most prized jobs on the reservation. Since there is no private sector, you know, your next best option is to become a fourth grade teacher. And the way you become a fourth grade teacher is by being a relative of somebody on the tribal council. It doesn't matter whether you're qualified to do it or not. But it's even worse than that, because one of the things she told me is that many years ago, a couple of years ago, she had a student who was not showing up for class. This was eighth grade. And, you know, just not showing up day after day. And she contacted the student's mother and said, look, if he keeps not showing up, I can't pass him through eighth grade. And the end of the year comes, and someone from the tribal council calls her principal and says, this student has to be passed to ninth grade, because he happened to be related to someone on the tribal council. So if you're, imagine you're a student in that school and you're witnessing this. I mean, there is no, it's all nepotism. It's all corruption. I mean, there's so little reward for merit that goes on that you would be discouraged. You couldn't help but just sort of throw up your hands and say, I give up.
Let's say that that you were one of an enterprising young student and worked hard in school and everything, and you wanted to start a small business on a reservation. Let's say open a little store or something. What kind of hoops would you have to jump through to do that?
Well, first you'd have to get money. I mean, I guess, you know, you could try cooking, you know, from the back of your trailer and try selling things out of your back of your trailer. But first you'd have to get the permission of the Bureau of Indian Affairs to do that. One morning I was staying, you know, I hate to harp on Pine Ridge, but I think it's such a good example of a lot of these problems. But one morning I was staying in a motel on Pine Ridge, and it was not the hunting season. So that meant that the diner at the hotel, the motel, was not open for breakfast. So I thought, okay, well, fine, I'll drive to the elementary school I'm supposed to visit, which was 40 miles away, and I'll just find a coffee shop on the way. I drove 40 miles, and I did not see a single store. I mean, there are not that many places in America you could do that. I mean, I've driven through rural Wyoming and Colorado and other places in the American West, and it's pretty much like clockwork. You'll encounter a McDonald's, a gas station, or something. I encountered nothing. And I told this to one of the people I was interviewing at the school, and she said, oh, there used to be a coffee shop right across from the motel. And I said, what happened? And she said, oh, well, the BIA wouldn't let them put up a sign on the road, so they closed.
Oh, my God. Now when you talk about the lack of entrepreneurial activity on reservations, I think a lot of people would immediately think of casinos. You have a somewhat sarcastic line in the book when you say, gambling, cigarettes, alcohol, drugs, who wouldn't want these businesses to form the economic backbone of their community? But these things are very profitable, so explain your skepticism on that front.
So what has essentially happened is that we have denied American Indians economic freedom and property rights, and essentially we've given them instead what I call in the book the loophole economy. We've said, look, here are these industries. You could have a tax or a regulatory advantage in these industries. We will let you do things that we won't let people off the reservation do. So for many years, obviously, for example, it was tax-free cigarettes. And, you know, so people would go to reservations and buy cigarettes for, you know, much cheaper than they would be able to buy off the reservation. And that was hugely profitable for many of these American Indians. They were making some – I was at the Seneca Territory in upstate New York, where this was a booming business. And one of the officials said, you know, people were making 300% profit at their convenience stores. And then the federal government cracked down and said, you know, with the something called the PACT Act, and basically they said, no, we're not going to give you this advantage anymore. We're going to take it away. And at about the sort of same time, you saw this sort of decline of the ability of Indians to have this advantage with cigarettes. Then they gained it with casinos. This has been the case since the 70s, but it, you know, really started to take off in the 90s, I would say. And again, what happened was states did not allow casinos to open, but the federal government said reservations can be exempt from these laws, and so Indians can open casinos. So, you know, we should start stipulate first that most of the casinos that are run by Indian tribes are these small dinky affairs, and the only people who ever come to them and gamble are Indians themselves. So it's like a lottery. It's just a tax on the poor. I mean, you're taking money that has been doled out to you by the tribal government, going and wasting it at a casino, which the profits then go to the tribal government and come back to you. But then there are these few big casinos that have done extraordinarily well, especially you find them in the Northeast and some in California too. So I went to, like I said, the Seneca Territory, and they've actually made $1 billion off of their casinos in the last decade and a half or so. It's been quite incredible. But the most shocking part is that you don't see much of an improvement in the standard of living in these communities. So they do have very lovely government buildings now, very nicely maintained. But as far as what actual individual Indians are getting out of this, it's very hard to see. The health care, I think, has been improved slightly. But they're still going to New York State schools and among the most deplorable schools in the state. And I asked them, I said, well, why aren't you spending some of this money to improve the educations of your kids? And they said, oh, well, we've paid for some extra security officers at the local school. $1 billion, and they're buying extra security officers. But all the profits go to the tribe, and then the tribe distributes this money in the form of annuities, most people understand. So on the Seneca Territory, when you turn 21, somebody sends you a check in the mail for $30,000. Now, up until this point, the chances are you've had a pretty dismal education. You've probably never worked. You've never saved or invested money. And somebody sends you this check. And the tribal officials will readily admit that people either spend this money on, you know, best case scenario, they buy a new truck. But more often than not, it's alcohol and drugs. And so this is kind of the why you see the community has not improved very much. And they're not doing very much to the wealth is not being diversified in some ways, because you still go through the main street of town and it's all empty storefronts. People are not using that $30,000 or the $7,000 or $8,000 they get every year in order to purchase better education, in order to train for a job, in order to start a small business. They're just using it for their basic subsistence, and it's providing them with a way of not getting a job.
Yeah, and on the education front, so what about child welfare? You mentioned the Indian Child Welfare Act, and as you know, we at the Goldwater Institute are litigating a class action lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which creates this sort of second-class system for foster care or adoption cases involving Indian children. And I recently had a month-long debate about the act at the Cato Institute's journal, Cato Unbound, just last month. Why don't you explain a little bit about why this act is such a problem for Indian children?
Well, as I alluded to at the beginning of our conversation, the child abuse that goes on some of the reservations is absolutely shocking. I mean, this was, as an author, this was the chapter that I put off for the longest because I could not bear, especially as a mother of three children, I could not bear to read these accounts of what was going on these reservations. Child abuse on reservations is about twice the national average, but you get these pockets, places like the Spirit Lake Reservation, where it is so rampant. And the really disturbing part is that you have all of this covering up that's going on. I mean, I compare it in the book to the case of Rotherham, England, or the case of the Catholic Church or Penn State, where essentially the adults in a particular community have kind of conspired to make sure that nobody gets caught doing what they're doing. But even on other reservations, you find a completely dysfunctional child welfare system. I was at a conference where I asked three educators who all worked on reservations if they had heard of a case of child abuse, who would they report it to? And one of the educators told me he would report it to the tribal officials. One told me he would report it to state authorities, and the other told me he'd report it to federal authorities. So the first problem, as you can see from those responses, is just a jurisdictional problem. Nobody really knows who is supposed to take final account, final responsibility for these actions. But then I spoke to people who worked in the judicial system, and they would say they had seen cases where judges were presiding over cases where custody cases or abuse cases where their family members were actually parties to the cases. It's worse than I think a lot of people are familiar with kind of, you know, what goes on in small towns. They could say, oh, well, you always have these conflicts of interest. This is so much worse than that. The kind of corruption that you're seeing is bad. And so I say all this as a preface to talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act, because I think what we have to understand is that there is a huge and desperate need to find good, stable families for a lot of these children. And unfortunately, a lot of those families cannot be found on reservations now. There are not enough stable, you know, stable families that are non-dysfunctional to be able to take in the children who need to be taken in. And so the fact that the federal government is going in and saying, no, the most important thing here is that the foster parents or the adoptive parents share the cultural heritage of the child, not as in the case of every other American child, we care first about the best interests of the child. That to me is just an enormous shame. And I am so glad that the Coldwater Institute is taking on these cases, because I just it is absolutely absurd and just an enormous, I think, national shame that we even have this law in the books.
It is one of the more remarkable things about the act is that it doesn't just apply to reservations. It applies to children throughout the United States off reservation if they are eligible for membership in a tribe. And since some tribes have very small amount of Indian heritage is required. For instance, the Cherokee, all you have to have is a direct ancestor who signed the 1907 Dawes rules, and an parent who's a member of the tribe. If that's the case for a child, then the child is deemed eligible for tribal membership, and their fate can be decided by tribal authorities, even if they're not and have never been to a reservation in their lives and have no cultural connection to the tribe whatsoever. It's really amazing.
And even if the person who is proposing to adopt or foster them does not plan to give them the least bit of education or about their cultural heritage, I mean, that's the other thing that's just so absurd about these cases, which is, you know, you see, you know, white parents or parents of other ethnicities saying, well, I would love to teach my child about, you know, what Native American culture is like. I'm happy to, you know, give them a culturally sensitive upbringing in all the ways that, you know, might be expected of me. I want to be respectful of their heritage. And they're being compared with a parent who happens to have some small drop of blood that is Indian, but has absolutely no connection to their cultural heritage. And so even on its face, I think the law is absurd.
Yeah, the way I often put it is the famous Texas historical figure Sam Houston was adopted into the Cherokee tribe when he was 16 years old. But under this law, he would not qualify as an Indian child because he has no Indian blood in his veins. By contrast, the little girl in the California case that's been getting a lot of headlines lately, Lexi, she's 1/64th Choctaw. Her great-great-great-great-grandfather was a full-blooded Choctaw Indian. So she qualifies as an Indian child, even though she has no cultural connection to a tribe and so far as we can tell, has never been to a reservation in her life.
Right. One of the women who I interviewed about this, she is not Indian, but her husband, her late husband was, and now she runs something called the Indian Christian Child Welfare Association or something like that. I'm not getting the name exactly right. But she recalled for me the day decades ago where she and her husband became aware of the Indian Child Welfare Act. They had been raising their children off of a reservation. Her husband wanted nothing to do with the kind of dysfunctional governance and everything that came with living on the reservation where he had grown up. And so the two of them were raising their children off the reservation. And she suddenly realized when she learned about ICWA that if something happened to the two of them, that their children could be taken back to live on the reservation where they had specifically decided they wanted their children not raised. And that was what had sort of turned her into an activist on this issue, where, you know, she realized that even her own wishes for what would happen to a child, you know, might not get the same kind of value in a courtroom as someone who just said, well, you know, this is the tribe to which they belong, and therefore they should be with their tribe members.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to ask one more question before we open it up for questions from people who have joined us on the call, and that is, we were joking before we went on about this, but why do you hate Indians so much? I mean, I kid because, but that is the charge that's going to, that if it hasn't already, is going to be thrown at you, that we're talking about these problems in Indian country, and that obviously the only reason that you're doing this is because you're a racist and you don't care about Indians. What would be your response to that charge? Which, again, if you haven't heard it, you're going to.
No, I absolutely have. I mean, look, I tried to explain why I first became interested in this issue. It was really a question of anger on my part, of sadness, of realizing that nobody else was writing about this issue, and they just felt that if they had written about it, I mean, the implication when a reporter says to you, I wouldn't touch that issue with a 10-foot pole, is exactly that. I don't want to be called a racist. I don't want to be accused of not being understanding and culturally sensitive enough about the plight of Indians. And I just, you know, I just have to say, look, obviously I don't have, you know, the cultural, the genetic connection here, but I feel like we are living in the wealthiest country on earth, and it is a huge blight, I think a shame on American national character, that we have these communities that resemble third world countries in the middle of this country. And the idea that people who are, you know, whether they're protesting Columbus Day or protesting the name of football teams, the idea that those people care more about Indians than people who are genuinely trying to work for some kind of reform. And by the way, the voices mostly in my book are Indians. I mean, I go to these reservations, I talk to people who run the tribal governments, people who are at the schools, people who are trying to change things on the reservations. The book is not filled with quotes by white people about what Indians should do. It's filled with quotes by Indians about what they wish Washington would let them do. And so, you know, I just, this is not a community that speaks with a monolithic voice, but I do think that the voice that we hear in the East Coast and our other elite circles, that is a monolithic voice. You know, it resembles in many ways, I think, the civil rights establishment, you know, that you hear from African Americans. I mean, it would be as if you say, well, Al Sharpton really represents all black people. And I don't think he does. And I don't think people who just say, you know, Indians are great, the situation that Indian communities have is great, and it would only be better if only we gave them, you know, a greater amount of cultural sensitivity. I think that is not a representative view among American Indians right now.
Yeah, I think it always bears emphasis because it's easy for us to overlook this fact. When we talk about Indians, I think there's this sort of basic assumption people come to it with, that we're talking about foreigners, that we're talking about people who, you know, are subject to some other government, so they're not really one of us. And all American Indians are citizens of the United States and have been since at least 1924. And, you know, we can't undo the Sand Creek Massacre, but we can certainly try and fix the problems among our fellow citizens today. So with that, I'd like to invite questions from people who have joined us on the call, and see what questions we might have for Naomi Riley about the new Trail of Tears.
Thank you both so much for this presentation. I'll now open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they're received. So again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first question.
Hello, this this is Victoria Sutton, and I should probably just tell you right away, I am Lumbee, and I listen to the Federalist Call, so I didn't just call in for this one, but I'm a member of the National Congress of American Indians Policy Advisory Board. I'm a Lumbee. I'm a law professor. I teach American Indian law. And I just want to say that I really applaud Naomi for taking on this subject. I'm on the policy board because we know we need to talk about policies in Indian country, and it's important. And we know things aren't good in Indian country. So I really applaud you, Naomi, and I think you really went about this really trying to find the truth. So I really do appreciate that. And one of the things I'd like to say, especially to Tim, because I know he's got a Hillsdale background, but, you know, one of the really interesting things is that our founding fathers did a lot of things to take the land, but they did the honorable thing by making a treaty with the Indians. So as good conservatives, the Federalists, we know that we have to honor our contract. So by honoring our contract, this is what it's created. So it's really hard to unravel the deal of taking land and giving in return the agreement to provide support for housing, education, and so forth. So it ends up being a very gnarly problem because of that contractual arrangement. But the another problem with that is that we can't even change those treaties because in 1875, Congress took the power away from the President of the United States to make treaties with the Indians. I think that's potentially unconstitutional because the Constitution gives the president that power. But now the president can't even make changes in those treaties, in those arrangements, which is another problem. And you might also not know that tribes can't even prosecute rapes and felonies on the tribe. They have to refer those cases to the FBI because for all the talk of self-governance, tribes are only allowed to prosecute cases that are less than felonies. So it's ended up with no rapes ever get prosecuted, which is a horrendous situation for tribes. So there are a lot of things that could be fixed, and I certainly agree with you, and I really am happy that you've written this book. And the comment you made about tribal membership, I just want to explain that in the law, tribal membership is a political affiliation, not a genetic one. So that's why you have the people who are like 1/5,000th Native American, even at that, and they're still a member of like one of the five civilized tribes in Oklahoma, which has that role. And it's really a political affiliation because it's really the only way that you can deal with it in the law, especially back when blood was, we didn't have DNA testing back when the tribes were formed, only roles. So this has just been a way to compromise to handle this commitment that was made by our founding fathers to the Native Americans. So I really applaud you, Naomi, for doing this. And in fact, I just wrote to the board while you were talking and said, I think we really should invite you to do a talk for our board so we can hear your suggestions. And then maybe you can hear a little bit about our perspective. But then you could tell us some of your perception coming into this. So I really do appreciate it. Thank you for doing this.
Naomi, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, thanks very much. I'm just trying to want to sort of just touch on a couple of points. Obviously, I agree with you. Maybe Tim wants to talk about this more, but yes, the question of how to untangle the reservation system, of how to make good on the treaties while at the same time trying to treat American Indians as American citizens is, I think, one of the naughtiest around. And I made reference to the Canadian situation, which is similar to ours, but different in other ways. They're trying to push something through called the First Nations Property Ownership Act, which would actually give the underlying title, it's in Parliament now and is being debated, and it would actually give the underlying title of the land to the tribe, but allow Indians and others to freely own completely outright the land and be able to, trade it, buy it, sell it among themselves or develop it as they wish. It would be like any other locality. When you buy and sell land in Boston, it doesn't cease to be part of Boston, but other people can own it. The other thing that I like to sort of just point out to people, in terms of our obligations, even if you take on its face the American government's obligation to provide, you know, healthcare and education to American Indians, I think that's something that, you know, the most people think the federal government has a duty to provide to all American citizens now. I mean, you can read the Constitution in any number of ways, but I think if you took a public opinion poll, I would suggest that, you know, most people think that we need a kind of safety net for all American citizens with regard to those two things. But I would say that the education and the healthcare we are providing on these reservations are pretty much the worst in the country. And so one of the things that we need to just think about on its face is there a better way we could be doing it? And I think too often the answer is, if only we threw more money at these problems, they would be solved. And in fact, I don't see that happening. I mean, as everybody on reservations will tell you, the Bureau of Indian Education schools are the best funded and they're the absolute worst schools on the reservation. I call in my book for charter laws in states like South Dakota and Montana, which have enormous American Indian populations, but are some of the few states left that don't have charter laws. And so these kids have no alternatives with the exception of a couple of struggling Catholic schools on the reservations. And similarly with health care. I mean, tribal health services, it's pretty much the last place anyone would want to go to get their health care. And so we have to think about, is there a better way we could be providing this? And the answer may not be, you know, giving more money to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It may be some other method that involves giving American Indians more control over this. It may be something that GASP involves the free market. And so I just think that we talk about this, we have to make good on our treaties, and we sort of spit out that line as if the answer coming from that is then obvious, but I don't think it always is.
Yeah, well, the question that was as to the issue of tribal membership being a political affiliation, it's that has become sort of a shibboleth among lawyers that tribal membership is a political classification and therefore it's not subject to stricter scrutiny in the courts. But in fact, when you look at the actual decision, in that case, it's the Mankari decision. That was a case that involved people who were adult members of a tribe, and the Indian Child Welfare Act applies to children who are eligible for membership in a tribe and are defined as Indians purely on the basis of their biological DNA. Also, the statute gives adoption and foster placement preferences to Indian families regardless of tribe, and therefore turns on the concept of generic Indianness, which does not exist except solely in a racial or ethnic sense. And so it really isn't true that in all cases where the government treats Indians differently than the non-Indians, that is simply a political affiliation. Finally, I'll add that on the question of the treaty question about how Congress disallowed treaties with the tribes, by far the most interesting opinions on this that have been written lately are by Justice Thomas. Justice Clarence Thomas has really taken a lot of interest in this issue and is regarded by some Indian law experts as the best friend of tribes in some respects, because he's called into question whether Congress even has the authority to discontinue treaties with tribes. Anyway, do we have another question?
I'll remind our listeners that to ask a question, you need to enter star and then pound.
And be brief.
Yes. In the meantime, let me announce our next scheduled teleforum conference call, which will be on Friday, September 9th at 2. We'll host a conversation about jurisdiction in the wake of the Supreme Court's 2014 Daimler decision. So keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls, and you can consult our website for a full list. Also, be sure to visit our website to listen to podcasts of our previous calls. Well, I have a quick question while we wait to see if anybody else does. I think Timothy mentioned this objection or something along those lines, but why wouldn't it help just to have more federal aid to solve a lot of these problems that the tribes and their reservations are having?
Well, I mean, obviously we have to start looking at the evidence. I mean, we have spent untold billions on these problems at this point. And I think one of the most interesting sort of interviews that I did on these reservations was, you know, a lot of times I was talking to older Indians and people who had you know, lived through many promises on the part of the tribal leaders who would say, if only Washington sent us more money, we would be able to fix these problems. And they've actually been able to see more money come in the forms of various grants for housing, for food aid, for health care, for education. And what these older tribe members will often say is, I just see things getting worse. People have taken me around and they said, you know, well, sure, I didn't have any indoor plumbing growing up, but at least the crime wasn't so bad. Or, you know, the epidemics of suicide are really a much more recent phenomenon. The gang violence also a much more recent phenomenon. So I think one thing to look at is, despite the increase that we have seen in aid from the federal government, the problems have not gotten any better. And I also would point people to, again, the just complete lack of a private sector. There are no plans that come from the federal government that say, this is how we are going to help Indians start businesses. This is how we are going to create a private economy. Almost all the money is going into public schools, tribal governments, tribal health services, or programs for young people. But you very rarely see any plan, because you can't do this. I mean, you can't simply drop down a lot of money and create a private sector. And I think that is, to me, one of the most important lessons of what we've seen with the casinos. Again, you go back to a community where essentially $1 billion has fallen from the sky on these people, and their standard of living has barely changed. It's because the entire system needs to change. It's not simply a matter of more money being sent in.
You know, the last question mentioned rape statistics and crime on reservations also. And, you know, and I think here in Arizona, we have the Navajo Reservation is, as I mentioned, it's 2.5 times the size of Massachusetts. The entire police department of the Navajo Nation is about 200 officers. And it simply is not possible to police an area that size with a force that small. But in your book, you aren't really confident in some of the statistics that suggest that Indian women are often victims of rape by non-Indians on reservations. Could you explain a little bit about that?
No, I actually delve quite deeply into the Bureau of Justice statistics, trying to figure out where these ideas came from. And I called a lot of bureaucrats, and I got a lot of fishy answers. I go into this in detail in the book. But South Dakota has actually done extensive research on this question. And it turns out that just like every other group, intra-racial crime is much more common than interracial crime. There is no epidemic, so far as I can see, of white people coming onto reservations, raping or doing violence to American Indians and then leaving. Most of what goes on is happening is Indian on Indian crime. And the problem is that I think we are focusing entirely on the wrong question here. The caller who previously brought up this question of whether these courts should be able to prosecute felonies, rape charges. I mean, there is this systemic problem here that is just not being addressed. And it starts with the fact that most of the rapes reported to the local police, there is no rape kit done. NPR has done stories about this. It's shocking, even at the level of reporting. But then, you know, you get to these questions about, should we be giving more power to the tribal government to try to prosecute these things? Unfortunately, what we see with the power that they already have is that it's often being misused or abused. Like I said, you have judges who are presiding over cases where their relatives are there. You have cases, you just had a case before the Supreme Court about what would happen, if someone was not, read their rights. And, you know, could that still be included? You'll explain this better than I can, Jesse. Could that still be included when we're using a federal three strikes and you're outlaw? Will the Indian prosecution count, even if the fact of the matter is that defendant has not been afforded their proper constitutional rights. And that's why, you know, the groups of defense lawyers do not want, American Indian courts to have the same kind of weight or to have more power than our state and federal courts do, because
we want them
to be held to the same standards.
I've often thought if I could wave my wand and fix just one thing about federal Indian law, it would be to make it that the Indian Civil Rights Act actually provided real protection for people against the power of tribal governments, which is lacking today. But we're running a little short on time, so I want to get to some questions if there are any from the listeners.
Let's do this one last question really quickly, caller. Thanks.
Hi. I have a question regarding the institution of communal ownership versus private property rights. Do you think it would be helpful in a positive way to institute private property rights throughout reservations to allow more individual initiative and decision making?
And specifically, if I could add to that, what is the status, do you know, of the First Nations Property Act in Canada right now?
It's kind of been put on hold because there was a Supreme Court decision in Canada that actually would have expanded Aboriginal lands beyond what they've traditionally had to lands where they were traditionally traveling to. It's a little bit complicated, but it's sort of through the efforts for the FNPO into a kind of holding pattern, because this Supreme Court decision in Canada could have the potential to significantly expand the amount of land that is even being talked about. So the short answer is it's on hold. To answer the caller's question, yes, I think private property rights, there was a book that came out a number of years ago. It said, property rights are not the magical solution that are going to fix everything. Actually, I think that they are. And certainly they are at the heart of any solution that needs to be arrived at here. I really think that American Indians who are living in crowded, temporary trailer homes need the ability to go to a bank and get a mortgage. They need the ability to go and say, no, I own this piece of land and I want to start a small business. Will you please give me some capital? They need to be able to buy and sell and develop land. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of untapped natural resources on these reservations that nobody has really, taken the time to understand, and the result is that we have trapped American Indians. Rather than giving them their rights as American citizens, we have trapped them in this kind of 19th century, as I said, socialist environmentalist utopia, and said, here, this is what your culture should look like now. And I think it's hugely unfair, and it is a violation of their rights as American citizens.
If either of you have any closing remarks, go ahead and make those.
Well, I want to thank you, Naomi. Did you have anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, I think that was that was probably my closing. But I want to thank you, Tim, for interviewing me.
Well, and thank you for writing this crucial book. I mean, there are very few books out there or publications of any sort that address the problems of Indian country from a property rights, individual liberty perspective, and that say, the promise of the American Constitution that all men are created equal and are entitled to certain inalienable rights applies to all mankind, regardless of race, even if they happen to be Native Americans. It's a shame that they have been left out of access to the American dream and are today still locked out of access to that. And your book, I think, is an important step in trying to remedy this long overdue problem.
Well, thank you very much.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Naomi Schaefer Riley and Timothy Sandifer for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next Teleforum Friday at 2 p.m. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.